This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The Reading Women body of work that you first encounter when coming into the room, I think it was in a lot of ways a response to the natural light streaming in through that window, and how the natural light is present in all of these portraits in this series, because it was just a structural issue. I was photographing with daylight balanced film, and I didn't want to use any artificial or supplemental lighting to take them, to kind of keep them very natural. Mm. So I think it's kind of a nice doubling of another underscore that this is about interiority. Mm. Yeah. So I hanging them low, I think, is definitely, I'm interested in having people who are seated,
yeah,
being able to experience them. And that's also a question of accessibility. I think that's something that is important to me.
But there's a mimetic relationship, or an analogical one, that's very nice. I was really glad that Kathy said that. Hmm. So do you want to tell us a bit about the series?
Yes.
And then, of course, we have Virginia Woolf's room of her own. Mm-hmm. Just the feminist project. Mm-hmm. How you came to have 100 friends. because these are all friends in these pictures, which is astonishing. You don't have to answer that question, but what that's all about for you.
Yeah, to make this body of work, Reading Women, I shot 100 portraits of artists, friends, many of them artists, writers, or musicians, each sitting in their own room or their own studio, reading a book of their choice that's written by a woman author. So even the title, Reading Women, is sort of a doubling of that, of those words.
They had to read an older woman's work,
though. No.
No, they all chose to do that.
Not all.
Most of them, right?
Many of them. Uh-huh. I think there are at least two that were younger. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, out of the 100 authors that were chosen, I think something like 65 of them were still living.
Yeah.
But I asked them to each read a book completely of their own choice. Mm. So people responded to that by maybe reading just what was on their bedside table or something that was very important to them.
Yeah.
For example, my friend Abigail, this is her portrait. The title is Abigail Reading Angela Davis, an Autobiography, 1974. And that context, I'm very insistent on that context is provided alongside the work. It's really important to me that the women are named and that context is there. But this book was her grandmother's book that was on her shelf. It was a first edition autographed copy. Abigail had never had a chance to read it. And so me asking her to just read anything gave her an excuse to pick up this book that she'd always been meaning to read. So she's kind of sitting there chuckling, reading it. But the way I asked each person to sit for 2 hours while I photographed and filmed them reading, and the 2 hours was important in that I wanted them to, as much as possible, kind of forget that I'm in the room. It's so very unnatural to have someone in your space training two cameras on you while you're doing anything. Uh-huh. So I kind of set it up so that they would eventually, I think, you know, it would become natural in some one way or another. And you can kind of see as I'm photographing and also filming HD video, you can kind of see them just relax over the course of that time. In the beginning, everyone is kind of a little bit obviously very aware, and then they kind of sit back in their chair, their jaw relaxes, and I think as much as possible, they're no longer posing or less aware of me being there.
So we had an earlier exchange at Pratt about this, and in which Carrie loves that Jeff Wall that you know, the stereo image that I think is so appallingly, so ugly. And so I asked her in a kind of teasing way, look at all that empty space above his head and look at the composition. And she said, I'm interested in absorption. So that, of course, immediately got my hackles up, because we know who is interested in absorption. And we had a very interesting exchange about the notion of absorption in Michael Fried, which is the autonomous artwork, the work that is uninterested in you and teaches you good manners, which is stay away, that is self-sufficient and monadic. And so, of course, that's not at all what Carrie had in mind. In fact, she didn't even use the word absorption tonight. But I have the feeling that even if that were the aim, the work would not be absorptive in that way because of her presence, of Carrie's presence. And I asked her, some of you know that I'm very interested in the moment in which photographs in the 19th century go from being in albums that you look down at to on the wall that you stand in front of, and that the preposition before has become very important. The moment at which a reviewer uses it is, I stood with astonishment before Gustave Le Gray's Sea and Sky, and that's like, duh! Because getting photographs, the whole issue of photography in the wall is so fraught. So I asked Carrie today to tell me what maybe spatial term or preposition she would use to indicate her relationship to the figure who was reading, in this case, Abigail?
Mm-hmm. The preposition, I think, that I can most relate to when making this body of work is definitely with. With that, I'm with these people. I'm not. I guess maybe just getting back to this idea of the mutual. And I think this is something that comes from your wall text. I very much relate to that. It was important to me that they be in their own spaces, that in their own mental space as well, that they have chosen something, that the book was a choice of their own, that they're kind of like, they're also simultaneously with another person, or like the creative output of another individual. And so I think that I'm alongside of them, I'm adjacent, but I'm not, I'm allowing them to be simultaneously autonomous, so but there's a connection, but
so I think that, you know, that it's very rich, and this is of course a Heideggerian notion, Mitsein, a kind of ethical disposition, a letting be, a being with and letting be. It's of course after his whole recantation of will, when will becomes something unthinkable for him. But this is, of course, a feminist and a somewhat political version of it that I like very much. It could be fun to think about that more together. I have another question that I didn't run past you in our trial today, but it's something you said when I was writing about that work. I said Vermeer, I brought up Vermeer, and I said, of course, you're using Vermeer lighting, and you said, it's not Vermeer, I'm doing a reading of Vermeer. Do you remember that?
I'm not sure, no.
No? Well, it kind of stopped me in my tracks, and you are doing a study of the reading woman in a certain sense, but it's also a reimagination of that act.
I mean, there's a lot I can say about that. I think it's interesting that there's this entire genre of painting and portraiture dedicated to the reading woman, or the portrait of someone reading. I think in a way, it's kind of an easy structural solution to asking someone to sit for a long time for you. I think it's a very respectful way of getting someone to donate their time, essentially. And I think that, so there is a kind of a lineage of this. And I think Vermeer so rarely, if at all, named the women who were in his portraits. I think that they remain anonymous, or there's
They have social, the maid, the mistress, yeah.
And I think I really related more to, I think specifically Griselda Pollock's read of like Mary Cassatt, our birth mare. Right. So these women painters who were making portraits of women who were engrossed in an activity so much so that they refuted the gaze, which was very topical at the time that Griselda Pollock was writing Vision and somebody help me.
I know exactly what you're talking about and have it on my shelf, but I can't remember the title.
It'll come back to me. Anybody? My mom, you know it?
Indifference.
Vision and Difference. Thank you. Thank you.
Who is he?
Mom. So I think it was important to me that the women be kind of portrayed as active subjects, that they were doing something that we as the viewer were not really given total entry to, or that that the gaze was not returned, that it wasn't invited, that they are perfectly fine on their own without us in some way.
Yeah. I think that it is very, there is a sense that so the reading women, it's not only that you don't know the identity of the reading woman or of the maid who might be in the room at the same time, but you don't know what they're reading, what the note that has been unfolded, the secret note or whatever it might be. And so it's clearly super important that you identify the authors of those books, at which point we realize that the notion of interiority is a very, very complicated one, and that it's a quite crowded room with you, what with you there. And Angela Davis, by the way, I had the unbelievable thrill of hearing Angela Davis when I was a student myself at UCLA before she... Before the law caught up with her, when she was giving a very passionate speech, and then of being colleagues with her at Berkeley, she went to Hayden White at Santa Cruz and said, I would like to finish my PhD, which she'd never done. And he said, fuck that. You're going to be a professor here. And how he got it past the state legislature, I will never know. But there she was, and to this day, I think she's retired now, but what a phenomenal figure, and how wonderful to have her somehow in the series.
I agree.
Yeah. Could you maybe just say something about the extensions that you're doing beyond the original conception, then we can move on to maybe something else?
Yes, yeah. So my current project that I'm working on now that is... I've kind of over articulated this project in order to get some funding, but I'm kind of in the early stages of inviting the living authors that were read by my friends for this project to sit and read for me as a way of kind of further mapping the transmission of ideas among makers and across generations, that there is this kind of intergenerational feminism that is something that's really interesting to me. So
that in a way doesn't exist, but that needs to.
That in a way it doesn't.
And I felt so strongly after the election, this failure at transmission. It was so painful to be watching women holding up women for Trump. I'm just unendurable. Or women not voting because they had on the left, because why should they vote for a woman? I mean, almost not voting because she was a woman, because of the demand that they as women do it, that was a link that they broke or that they refused to forge to begin with. And then I thought, oh man, is there a lot of work to do for your generation?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say about that, this has become so incredibly topical. Unfortunately, I think what a tragedy to have to kind of happen to be able to have this conversation begin in a really big way in this country. And I have a lot of faith that people are going to be refuse to remain silent.
Yeah.
And I think that my project, I think, foreshadows the opposite of what you're saying.
It does.
I mean, I do believe, you know, like my friend Colleen, who's about to have a big show at the ICA next year, here she is in her studio in Chicago.
Yeah.
I photographed this, I think, in 2012, reading Gwendolyn Brooks' Blacks.
Yeah,
like, I think she's, you know, who are we reading? And I think that was a way of me, just in this really sincere way, just asking my friends, who are you being influenced by? What are you looking at? What are you reading? And so in a way, it's kind of like exposing my girl crush on like all these people who are like, you know, Cecilia, she's a musician who created the soundtrack for my Burning House video. She's reading Alejandra Pizarnik, an Argentinian poet.
But you're bringing them together and turning it into, I mean, it's not only a very unusual canon that it makes no pretense to objectivity or any of those absurd values, universality or any of the values on which the traditional canon was put, but also you're stitching them together into something that is a very unconventional canon, but it also very unconventional collectivity or assemblage. There's something almost optative, or what if, or why not, or perhaps it could look like this.
Yeah.
Wouldn't this be more appealing to you?
I agree. I mean, I think in a way, I took a snapshot of my cohort, you know, from 2012 to 2014, and so it is like this moment of just recognizing who I'm already surrounded by.
Yeah.
So I didn't try to go find people who represented every political spectrum or every nationality. You know, I think it was just impossible to do some sort of survey, and that wasn't my project. That's not something I was interested in. I kind of was interested in a way, looking at my immediate circle and what people who were already inspiring me as a maker.
Yeah.
But I think, you know,
why not start with love, you know? Why not start there? I always think of that moment in Camera Lucida when Bart is talking about the violence that the photograph can do, certain photographs have done, and he said, only love, extreme love, can mitigate that violence of a writing, a speaking voice. Anyway, do you want to say anything else about maybe one last thing, and then I'm not keeping track of time, are you?
I was going to show just a still of the Yvonne.
Okay.
Oh, here's all 100 of them. There's at least one in this room.
That's interesting. Have you ever shown it that way?
No, but they're all represented in the video. So all 100 portraits are represented in the video, which is installed in the other room. So as I mentioned, meanwhile, as I was photographing their portraits, I was also filming
simultaneously. Yeah, but I like this because there's some simultaneity. There's a co-presence that I think is really interesting.
I think in my very earliest just the idea of how on earth would I show this, like hours and hours of footage of people reading. I thought, like, I'm going to install them like this in a room, and you're going to enter into this like concentration hive. And it was kind of like, this would be amazing. And then people will read in there. I don't know. I was filming this like hours of footage, and I had no idea what I was going to do with it. And I think what I eventually did was I edited the footage so that you see each woman for about 3 to 5 minutes until she turns the page. So it's this kind of non-arbitrary structuralist edit where you can see her, and then it ushers in the next sitter at that apex of the page turn. So it's a way of not just being patronizingly long, but again, we get to see each woman at a moment when she is deeply engrossed in her text. So here's some of the...
You have a bunch of them.
Yeah, at the end of every shoot, I photographed each person's hands holding open the book.
So you actually have...
I have all 100 of them.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So this
that's
is
beautiful.
Holly reading Yvonne Rainer.
Oh, that's beautiful. We should have had those.
Well, next time.
Wow.
So this is what then led me to asking Yvonne Rainer to sit and read for me. The next iteration of this project is what I'm doing now. So Yvonne, I've had a small handful of the authors that my friends read sit and read for me. So Yvonne was actually the first. So her video's on the Verso side of the women reading, and she. In this video, she's actually reading a text that she wrote called Laughter and Anger in the Time of the Assassins. It's about the laughter in a dark time, kind of creating community. Tung wrote the most beautiful wall text
she
about
did.
It. You should watch it because I think it's become even more important to kind of listen to that text now.
It's funny that you invoked the Hannah Arendt Friends in Dark Times. Hmm. Yeah, that's a kind of... I start the introduction to Flesh of My Flesh, I think. Hmm. Don't I in the preface with that passage?
Mm-hmm. The book on me.
Okay.
For once, I don't have the book on.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of more than private too. Hmm. There's something more than private about that.
Hmm.
The dark times, of course, are shared dark times. Mm-hmm. They're not the dark times she's talking about were, of course, the time of fascism. But how we think the private and the public together, how we bring our loves, the things that we care about and that are important to us into some relationship with this sphere of the social that we've largely vacated. I mean, how to populate it once again. And I love that so much, that Henri Salla film about the mayor, this mayor of a town, Tirana, in Albania, right?
Yes.
So the city is, this is after East Bloc communism in the end, and the entire city is just destroyed and no one would want to live there and nobody goes out into the public space and everyone builds from the inside out with utter disregard in a totally American way for the shared space that everyone is then going to be looking at. And he's a painter and he looks at the rats and the sewage and there's nothing he can afford to do. And so he starts painting all of the outsides of the house like Mondrian paintings with colors. He chooses the colors and he says, everyone starts going to the cafe and arguing and talking about colors. So fantastic. And it becomes a way of recreating a public space.
Beautiful. It brings me to a question that I had wanted to ask you. Maybe this is a good time. I just to pull out a quote from Flesh of My Flesh. Which I should just have in my lap, but I wrote it down. Also in the introduction, you talk about analogy as, I'm just going to paraphrase this part shortly. Analogy is the structure of being, and it gleams with promise because it does indeed have the power to save us. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that, kind of the social potential and of finding similarity in a culture that so prizes individuality.
So I feel like I would have a lot to say, but that I should postpone this till the end because to see how much time we're going to have because this is your show. But I do believe... that it has the power to save us. And I do believe that two is the smallest unit of being. Mm. And I do look with utter dismay at the ever smaller, it's America's love affair with the individual is as strong on the left as it is on the right, and it is what I call the one and only, you know, the one and only. This book has a lot to do with that, arguing against that and the moment in which that emerges, which is in effect the 15th century. And yeah, it's very terrifying to think that we now have a president, in effect, who is the very incarnation of that principle. There's only room in this town for one of us. But what if there's only room in the world for one of us? And that's kind of how it's looking. And I just think we're due for a really, really intense reckoning around notions of ownership, individuality, personhood, territory, boundaries, that all of that stuff is so badly in need of being rethought. And I was invoking, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about this right now, for Carrie, this bumper sticker that some of you have heard me talk about before, that one of my neighbors in Oakland had, and it was after the Iraq War had started, and it said, so everyone who knows me knows that I'm an atheist, and what I'm about to say does not alter that, so you just fill the first word, which is God, in with whatever you want to fill it in with. God bless everyone. Period. No exceptions. That's unbelievable. No exceptions. Not Hitler? No exceptions. Not Donald Trump? No exceptions. The minute there's an exception, it's a totality, in effect, and it's the refusal to eject anybody from it, because you only have to do it once until you start throwing more and more and more things out there, and you end up with the situation that we're in now. And there has to be some kind of affirmation of our connectedness, not at the level of our beliefs or our politics, at the level of our being, I guess is how I feel that has to be, and that we can't be nullifying, negating each other at that level. It's just appalling beyond belief. It's like during the German autumn, the Schwein, you know, the use of non-human terms to refer to. It was happening on both sides of that. The people in Shamheim refusing to let the terrorists, so-called terrorists, the RAF, be buried in their graveyard. Judith Butler being burned in effigy in Brazil by people who are coming up and calling her a witch and a devil. I mean, anyway, enough of that. But Wendy Brown, you can see this on the YouTube. It's really quite something. When Judy vanishes at a certain point, because, I mean, who wants to listen to that? But Wendy's like a knight in shining armor taking them on. It was so fantastic. So I encourage you all to see that. It just happened a couple of weeks ago.
Huh. Extraordinary.
Burning her in effigy. So anyway, back to you. So now we're going to talk about derelict self.
Oh, did we already? Yeah. Talking about two is the smallest unit.
That's funny.
You said it.
No, that's really funny to think of. Yeah, that's really interesting. Huh. Yeah.
So derelict self is the earliest body of work that's represented in this show. I made it from 2006 to 2007 when I was a graduate student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. There are 10 photographs of myself and my slightly older brother doing these pretty mundane things with me mimicking him directly behind. When I started making the work, it was very much culling from my own memories of being a younger sister and looking up to him so much so that I wanted to wear his hand-me-downs. And I think in hindsight, I can see that there was this kind of very, very thin line between wanting to be like him and wanting to be him. So I think in a way, kind of performing this body of work allowed me to kind of act that out in kind of an absurd way, and kind of these moments of mimicry that would be maybe quite normal at the age of 3 and 4 would be totally taboo at 25 and 26.
One is especially intense. But there's the one in bed too, right? But you told me, if we can go back to the very first slide, when I was in your studio, you told me that you blushed. You blushed.
That's a real blush.
That's a real blush, yes. Yeah. It's such an interesting series in so many ways, one of which takes me, I didn't write it in the wall text, but it takes me back to my days of teaching psychoanalysis, that one way out of a taboo desire is to convert it into identification. Mm-hmm. I can't have, but I can be, and vice versa. So the slippage between those two modalities is well greased, so to speak. Hmm. And you're moving around, careening around inside it, and as a child, obviously, and then I wrote about this revelation that I had while I was writing that series, the impersonal nature of the incest taboo, that it's a law, it's a no, it's the induction into culture. These are the ways in which I had always approached it. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, this is so personal, and the law has nothing to say about it, actually. But the law is going to define it even before it represses it. It's going to say, this is what it is, and reduce it. Reduce the complexity, make it, nominate it, and render it non-ambiguous and fixed. And then, of course, it becomes the core around which guilt is going to congregate for the rest of your life. So that we have, as I seem to be invoking an awful lot of Freud tonight, this great theory that Freud has, pleasure for me as a conscious subject is unpleasure for me at the level of the unconscious, and vice versa, so that we are never happy or at home with our pleasures because of this conflicted relationship we have to them. And oh God, I mean, I don't know if other people can recognize that, but I certainly can. The uneasiness that one has around pleasure, and that series, I think, is so eloquent about that, quite apart from the specificity of that relationship.
I don't know how to say it better. I mean, I think I can just point to the blush as being evidence of just this physical, the bodily reaction to the taboo. I mean, I was just, there's nothing going on in this picture. I'm just close to my brother in a library. And it was too much. Like, I knew there was something kind of, I mean, I hug my brother, but like to be this close to him, it was like, I knew there was something charged about that. And so I think it's just,
It's also, I think we could go back to the exchange we were having about the public and the private. It's you learn, quote unquote, as adults to maintain some distance. Mm-hmm. You know, in different cultures, of course, it can be very different. But Americans, people get too close to you on the bus, or there's a sense of they're encroaching on your space. Mm. Your personhood is being violated, et cetera. And that proximity issue seems to be something very closely related to the individualism again, so that this series is not just addressing that, but in the sense of private personhood and its personhood and its relationship to private property, and the taboos that we have, not just around the incest. Sometimes I think that Americans are more that taboos around people asking you about how much you earn or coming into your living room, that these are the ultimate taboos around private property, even more than sexuality, although Lord knows we have got lots of those. Well, so we have how many photographs do we have in Derelict Self? And do you want to say something more about those that we don't have, but that
sure.
you have in the slideshow?
I don't remember which ones exactly, if this one, I don't think this one is in it. Yeah, there was something I was going to say about I think just thinking about taboo and intimacy and closeness and the physical closeness,
yeah.
I think that part of me was just wanting to mourn or just recognize the fact that this familial intimacy is totally taken away from us. It's ripped away, I think, without any real acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's totally inappropriate to be so close to.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you said two is the smallest unit of being. I was a little bit taken aback by that, but now I'm thinking that's really good. That children are not fully differentiated from their parents. I sold my car yesterday. I'm now a very happy driverless. I never have to drive again. But the person I sold it to told me this fantastic story that is connected to this. And but it's about bones rather than flesh. But she was in, I think, Norway, or Portugal, with babysitting a child. And they went to look at a skeleton, and they talked about bones. And then later that night, the child was falling asleep on Charlotte's body, and she said, "I like the way we're mixing up our bones." Huh. I thought that was so touching. Huh. I mean, a 3 or 4 year old, so able to affirm that proximity and that connectedness and that interminglingness. That then, because we have to be freestanding individuals. So the whole etymology of individuals, very fascinating. It's one, it means one, and it was mostly invoked around the Trinity and the trouble, the difficulty of arguing that the three-person God, which is what I'm riffing off of, is actually one. It's one God, three persons, but one God. And so this whole issue of personhood is already there within the religious domain, and it means only. Only one. Only one. And I'm the only one who's really one. And those are impossible mandates that, in effect, we imposed upon ourselves at the moment that we decided that we only needed one world instead of two, and that we could take the place of the otherworldly demiurges that we had fantasized into existence. And then we, Pandora-like, we took this poison shirt upon ourselves, and I'm really waxing very eloquent, don't you think?
Yes,
I do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like the second time today when something that you've said has really invoked for me the idea of of dovetailing, the carpentry of kind of being together,
right?
But separate. I don't know. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah.
The bones.
The bones.
Wonderful.
Yeah, beautiful. So this is this. Can you go back to that one?
Sure.
That one, of course,
is in the show.
Yeah, is the one where from a distance they they seem to have become a single person. In a way, you're I'm just having this idea for the first time, which is pretty exciting. I mean, I'm always very excited by my new ideas. So this one is that you are exploring the kind of analogy I write about in the last chapter of Flesh of My Flesh, that I argue is specifically photographic, which is one in which there is a minimal difference, in which similitude almost overwhelms difference, but that small sliver maintains the two as the two that is the smallest unit of being and doesn't allow it to collapse into the one of the individual.
Huh. That's beautiful. Yeah, I think that this, it's made me think so much about the origins of making this body of work was really around mimicry and how there's one attempting to be like the other and kind of thinking so much about what Freud and Lacan have said about the doubling and mimicry and Freud and the uncanny, thinking about like post-colonial theory, Homi Bhabha's writing on mimicry is kind of a colonized population as a way of gaining knowledge and gaining power. This is something we've talked about. I think that kind of always has this kind of tragic underbelly for me, that there's this like loss of the subject in this attempt to kind of gain knowledge by trying to see oneself in the world. There's a loss of the self at the same time, and I think that that it just exposes something. Mimicry for me just exposes something about this social fabric that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to say anything? So Tung wrote so beautifully about. Did you have a chance to look again at their text?
Yes,
because she brought Kaiwa's essay on mimicry into the discussion
of Dazzle
Camouflage, which was so we didn't plan to talk about that, but now we are talking about that. So what is Dazzle Camouflage? Where does the title come from?
Well, Dazzle Camouflage is the title of the photograph over here. It's a Dazzle Camouflage was a technique used by the British Navy during World War I that was a kind of pre-radar. It was an attempt by the Navy to try to dazzle the perception of the enemy torpedoists. So they would actually hire artists to paint these amazing op art patterns on the side of their warships. And apparently it did not work at all, except for to raise the morale of the troops, which I think is fascinating. This piece, I mean, I think the way that Tung wrote about it so beautifully is thinking about camouflage as being present in nature, that it is a form of mimicry in a way. And I think it's a way of blending in, but then also, it's a mimesis that occurs in nature. And I think that that's a very, very beautiful, eloquent connection. The parenthetical title for this piece is also For Peter. I think it's, I was very compelled by seeing an artist talk by the painter Peter Doig when I was in residency at Skowhegan, and he was talking about this really flat-footed way that he was inspired to paint his iconic paintings of canoes, of the lone canoe.
Yeah,
that there was so much read into that as being this kind of, you know, this vessel that was a stand-in for a human psyche, and he just admitted to kind of having seen. What is the horror film?
You're probably going to be more up on this than I. I'm terrified by horror films.
My memory has gotten so bad. It's just a still from a horror film that he saw. He was sitting at home and kind of photographed it from the television. I think that there's just something. I just love just like that the democratic way that images that we as artists can kind of cull from something like a the canon of art history or kind of the just something that is just visually resonant.
Yeah, and that I think would probably bring us to this.
Sure, unless you want to talk about the perverse sister, I imagine, as you call
yes.
it.
Yes, oh my God, yes, we want to talk about the perverse sister.
So this is the last, well, I don't usually show it lasted, but it's the final slide of the derelict self photographs. And yeah. Kaja asked me to put it last, which I would not normally, but it's over
I
here
separated
on the wall.
It. That's my print there. I think it is a masterpiece, and I have actually repeatedly insisted, but she has not obeyed yet, that it be removed from the series, because I think it is. But now, of course, I'm arguing against myself in a certain sense, because I was going to say because I think it's freestanding, but of course, I've just denied that there can be any such thing. I think it should be linked somehow to this one. Hmm. Yeah. But in keeping it here, I separated it to, and also from the others spatially, and I put the text in between, and I wrote about the very different affect, the very, very different feeling. And so you may notice that there's a white frame around it, and how wrong it is, but it's completely right for all of the others. It's working a sepia chromatic range, and it's just got a kind of atmospheric old master thing going on.
Curators.
Can't live with them, Jeff.
I am so interested in your read of this photograph. I shot both this photograph and then the next work that we'll talk about, Las Bebidas. I shot it in the same bar in Chicago where I was living at the time. Mm-hmm. It's called the Rainbow Club. I actually have a show up there right now. It's kind of just been this dive bar that's been around for forever. Yeah. Like Nelson Algren used to hang out there.
You have it up at the top. Do you want to talk about that?
What's that?
Isn't the exhibition that's up now in the space?
Sure. Well, when I shot this photograph, it's very hard to see the artwork that's kind of in the shadows above the booths. It was an exhibition by someone else. Mm. And I thought that was like another... That was exactly what was happening in Las Meninas. Velasquez, he shadows out all of the paintings of his predecessors, the previous royal court official painters are kind of put in the shadows quite literally. So it was kind of maybe throwing some shade, but yeah.
So I think this is the first large format photograph, the first double-sided, the first picture that understands the double-sided nature of the perspectival picture. Alberti has this incredible passage in his book where he talks about the extrinsic rays of the perspectival rays, that the ones that go outwards as wrapping around the picture like a cage, which is really, really unbelievable. And I have come to think that Alberti is an unreliable source of information about the perspectival picture, because the minute painting comes down from the wall, has a space of its own, has to find its way back onto a different kind of wall, it has become a thing to be seen, which means it cannot do without a beholder. So if the author enters on stage right, the beholder enters on stage left, and Alberti doesn't want anything to do with that because he wants theological authorship. I mean, when you read that passage in which he talks about the picture being like a window, it's just, it's like divine performatives. I decide what size I want. Every single sentence is like that. And you know, I decide and what I want and what I will, and really fierce. Hmm. I think that because When Leonardo says from the mind to the hand, he does an end run around language, which no one ever talks about. Mm-hmm. And Alberti does that too. So God of Genesis says, let there be light. But then there is the second part of that, which all of these artists are working with. God looked and saw that it was good. Mm-hmm. So it's like the mind invents so quickly that it passes into the hand without even going into language. But we don't want to have a beholder who, we don't want that dependency on a beholder. Hmm. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that last part. I realize that was only half explained, but it would take us too far away. Hmm. But just that I think that the perspectival picture has a space in front of it, which is a space for the beholder, and that this is the first picture that acknowledges that double-sidedness, which is about the facing relationship between the picture and the beholder, which is about our facing relationship to each other, ultimately. Hmm. Or so I'm writing in that picture. And this is, I think, an amazingly important painting and photograph. It was, everyone was obsessed with it in the 19th century, as I write, and it was called a photograph repeatedly. Hmm. It's the moment, it's some point of miraculous convergence between the two. So Foucault, by calling a representation, manages to seal it shut. Mm-hmm. Again, it's what I call the pictorial lock, the lockdown. Nothing that is in will get out, and nothing that is out will get in. Hmm. So you either have the beholder as a element of the picture itself, cage locked shut, it has no agency, or you keep it from ever having any relationship. You know, and Michael Fried says, Manet teaches us good manners. Stay away, keep out. Hmm. You know, it's unbelievable. Hmm. Or Michael Fried talking about Gursky, he's showing us a prison for God's sake. He's showing us a prison and a picture that is letting us off the hook. We are outside. We could never be in a prison. That could never affect us. And he's celebrating what he calls severance, which is deeply ethically problematical.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think the Foucault text that you're talking about, his essay, Las Meninas, in the order of things, was definitely a guiding force of the way that I read this. And I had never thought about his naming of the kind of this painting was about representation. I never
he takes
thought of that as being a way of a closure.
That's why it has the status that it does. That inducts us into the world of difference, out of the world of analogical signs. Representation floats free of. It is not answerable to the real. Hmm. So that's how he's using it. I mean, it's a brilliant reading in many respects. Mm-hmm. It is a brilliant reading, but the fascinating thing to me is that it's all Merleau-Ponty that he has just post-structuralized. Hmm. And it would be an impossible reading if it weren't for Merleau-Ponty. Hmm. So Merleau-Ponty is going to have his day in the sun.
Great.
If I have anything to do with it. So how are we doing with time? 7:40? Okay, so we have time. Yeah, we have time. So let's not talk about that just yet. Let's end maybe with that.
Okay.
Okay, and go to, let's talk about this.
Oh, okay, so Burning House is the video that's usually being projected right here in the exhibition, and the photographs are not in the show. Mm. They weren't available, but the The video is 14 minutes long on loop, and it shows a house perpetually burning through all different times of year, sorts of weather, times of day. So
tell the backstory.
So in order to make this body of work, I shot this right before I started making Reading Women. I built a small shack that's about 8 feet by 8 feet by 6 feet wide. It's just a small hermit shack. And I built it a dozen times. And each time I would put it in a boat and I rowed it to a middle of a lake in north central Wisconsin. And I burned it down. So I would set it up and then I'd burn it down completely, all while photographing it and filming it from the same vantage point on land. So I burned it all the way down, photographed and filmed it with two cameras side by side, the same way that I was shooting Reading Women. And then I just did it again and again. So this one was photographed in August. This is another August. This one is in December, February. I think this was in January at night.
She did not burn the tree.
I did not burn the tree. Yeah, there's one tree on the island, but it's actually a little bit further back from the house. It was one of the first bodies of work where I was simultaneously shooting and still in moving images. It's something that I'm still fascinated by.
Yeah, which we can maybe talk about. But I'm wondering, so there's the kind of minimalism of the repeated action. The repeated action without an apparent destination or logic, so to speak, right? A lifting of it out of, so to speak, narrative time and into this repetitive serial time.
Synchronic time. Smithson talks about.
Yeah, yes. So let's talk a little bit. I asked her earlier if we would call this earth art, land art, how she would position herself in relation also to Mendieta. So where she would land with that?
I mean, when I was making this work, I was so excited when you asked me that because I love talking about Smithson in relation to this work that I was really interested in his thoughts in particular on exactly what we were. Sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second.
Smithson and this, yeah.
He was repetitive. Thinking about synchronic versus diachronic time. I think that was something that I was really fascinated by, that they're in kind of showing this thing that never completely burned down. I would only, kind of in the same way that I'm only showing these Reading Women at their most like intensely engrossed, that was at the same way that I showed the house it's burning. You're never seeing it burn down completely. So the way that the film loops, it just looks like it's this house that's always this impossible thing. I was interested in Robert Smithson. He was discussing entropy and his fascination with entropy. One thing that he said in particular that really resonated with me was talking about Duchamp reassembling panes of broken glass as a gesture against entropy. And that was something that just really kind of stood out to me as kind of thinking about a potential gesture against entropy. So that's how I started kind of framing this work for myself.
Right. Okay, so what is... so it's... you and the landscape. So what is happening here in this encounter? What is that about?
What is it about? I mean, I think this was the first body of work that I had really made. I mean, the Dazzle Camouflage came right before this. It was shot in the same lake. I was really interested in not having myself in the work for a minute, like literally just to not be depicted in it, but to have the presence of that performance be there. And there was something, I think, about this landscape that, I mean, I don't know, I think that just there's something really dramatic about just the seeing the changes of light, atmospherics. I think there's something kind of classic about that that was just fascinating to me, that there could be all of this, that that kind of becomes the more dramatic backdrop to this thing that is so wrong, that those, you know, this burning house is this universal symbol of distress, and to have this that become the constant among this world that's so constantly changing.
So Jessica, would you please read the last paragraph of your text?
Yes, sorry.
I know. Not to put you on the spot.
because this is very beautiful.
It's really, really.
And it's an alternative reading. Oh, come on.
Jeez, Mike, so great.
Okay, it's been a while since I've read this. But amidst Wisconsin's painterly landscapes with their jewel-toned skies and green tufts of changing trees, the square frames and triangle roofs of these solitary houses call to the larger context of the domestic sphere. As they burn, the structures evidence or stand for Schneider's elaborate, labor-intensive process for which she performed a role traditionally relegated to men, construction. As she burned it down, set it alight from the feminized inside out. But this destruction is not merely a protest, and nor so much was their construction. These are not the lonely homes of an evacuated American dream, nor the private property with its attendant nuclear family set aflame, nor even the condensed icons of a larger historically oppressive domestic landscape, but maquettes, glowing and quiet, whose fiery light fights with the darkness, echoes the sunlight, and whose destruction is fully an opening to the world and an unfolding unto the air. It's very different.
Very different.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's pretty great, huh?
Really great.
Yeah. So how do you feel about Jessica's
I think it exposes for me, so many things about how a work can be read in so many different ways, and how often, you know, when I talk about my work, sometimes I just have to choose the first starting point or one of the starting points. And I think that, you know, acknowledging the housing crisis was something that was definitely going on while I was making this work, that was something that was in the forefront of my mind, thinking about this is a feminist gesture. I mean, hell yeah. I mean, I think there are all these things that are definitely present in there for me.
I also think of V.S. Selman's Burning Houses. Those are also... she says falling out of the picture plane. That's how she defines her sculptures, which I love. And she saw these burning houses in Eslington when her family was having to escape. But somehow it's a magical thing, and it's one of them has fur inside representing the flames.
I know that one.
Yeah, some transmogrification, that metamorphosis that I think Jessica was getting at there. And Kathy Sachs said something very interesting too, that the flame at a certain point becomes a kind of candle when the house is almost burned down. At any rate, there's something very importantly durational about that work, and because we're getting very close to the end of our time, there is also about summer drawings, although they are very different from this work. And Jessica also wrote very well about them.
She did. Yes, she did. Yeah, I think Jessica in her wall text, again, reminds me of something that was a real starting point for the work, and thinking about the pencil of nature, and kind of thinking about the etymology of what photograph means, of kind of drawing with the light, and kind of thinking the my motivation for thinking of them as drawings, summer drawings, was for me kind of a way of wanting to make something that was more spontaneous, that kind of I could In the same way that, you know, making this work with Kyle, that he wanted to improvise. I think for me, there, you know, I started being an artist by being a painter, and I think that by allowing myself to use these my large format 8x10 camera and exposing a photographic paper in within the camera rather than a negative, that there is this unique print that's created. And still kind of thinking about portraiture and that relationality.
The relationship between the human and the non-human, too.
Yeah, and a way of collapsing time. Mm. I mean, it is another way of collaging a multitude of moments. Mm-hmm. I think that it's just kind of... I was working much more intuitively. It was a place that I needed to be in, and kind of shifting scale on this one. It's called Winslow and Floating Dock Lovers. On Winslow's lapel, you can see in the distance, there's a kind of a little cameo almost of two people floating on a dock in a lake in Oxbow in Michigan when I was at an artist residency there. But I got to paint a bit more, and I think in the same way that I...
You mean it felt like you were painting?
I mean, literally, I was painting.
Oh, you were literally painting.
I mean, I was painting and photographing gestures.
Okay, all right, that's really interesting.
And a lot of them did end up having windows in them as well, I think kind of in a way of referencing the camera, the dark room.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I think we should leave some time for Q&A, so let's just end with this.
Doop.
So the number of artists who have, Morimura has done an entire series in which she occupies every conceivable position within this, from the Infanta to Velazquez to hall of mirror kinds of things, in which in one work there is a perfect mirror image of this is completely mirrored on the other side by an identical scene. All kinds of elaborate things that it's a very, I think, smart series. I think you could use it in a literature class and really get a lot of mileage out of it. It doesn't feel very photographic to me, weirdly, although I think it's very smart, as I said. But there is, of course, Picasso. And then there is Richard Hamilton doing Picasso, doing Velazquez, and it's almost a rite of passage for the male artist. As I have come to see Bad Goods, we don't have that, do we? Bad Goods is improbably, that's a Jeff Wall, is clearly his version of Las Meninas. He gets rid of everything but the figure in the doorway. the Infanta turns into a bunch of rotten iceberg lettuces. It's a very odd work.
It is, yeah.
So what attracted you? What? Why?
I was studying at the Art Institute of Chicago in my last semester, and my brother, who I had been making this work with, had kind of a quarter life crisis and moved to Montana to snowboard. He quit his job.
To snowboard?
And yeah, without any, yes. And so I lost my muse. Mm. And so I was kind of trying to figure out what, I mean, I've got my MFA students here, you're like, what the hell am I doing? I'm sorry, but it's just like, what am I doing? And I felt like I just couldn't even conceive of my place in the world as an artist, you know. Yeah. And I think that there were so many things kind of driving making this work that I knew there was something really wrong with making this work. Like, I should not be doing this.
You should be doing it.
Well, I mean, in a way, I had to make it. I mean, I think that it's incredibly flat-footed. Again, I mean, I think just in this really definitely flat-footed way, and just like using this painting to make, to just lay the tracks to make this photograph. And I think I was trying to kind of find these contemporary counterparts that were meaningful to me and resonant with me. But one thing that really motivated me was thinking about, I was at the time, my graduate advisor was Greg Bordowitz. And he had accused me, right before I started making this work, he had accused me of being afraid of allegory. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And that's when he said, all right, well, we'll see you next week. And then the next week that we met, we just walked through the Art Institute of Chicago together, which is this really wonderful thing about being in a school that's like paired with a museum. And so we walked around the halls and looked at all these old still life paintings. And I was really attracted to these kind of what I don't know if this is a real term, but I was thinking of them as these populated still lives. And so I started just shooting these still lives in this bar that I was just frequented. It was right around the corner from where I was living at the time. And I knew all of the bartenders, and they just would let me go in during the day. And it was my favorite. It's still my favorite thing to go there at 4 p.m. when they open. so I think I just was kind of thinking, like, this is where I belong as an artist. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the present day royal court in a way? And so I think it was my answer to a lot of those kind of very personal questions. But I think, you know, in just understanding what I knew, I mean, I had seen this painting in the Prado in Madrid when I was 20, my first time I'd ever gone abroad, you know, as a Midwestern girl, you know, and kind of just being so overwhelmed by it. And just understanding a little bit about the art historical ink that had been spilled about it, you know, and just knowing that it was just very bombastic for him to make this work, to kind of situate himself within the realm of the royal and to kind of acknowledge his esteemed position in it. Yeah. I mean, he was very important in that place.
Well, you know, he was a curator. That was a space where he collected the art. He was the art collector. Hmm. He was the painter, the art collector, and the curator. Hmm. And here he also makes himself the viewer and the sitter. So it anticipates Steichen in a certain sense and what I call the four-person picture.
The four-person picture. Well, we haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, so the three-person picture is the sitter, the beholder, and the author. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that the three-person God falls into the world of the secular and becomes the three-person picture and can no longer deny that there are three persons in it.
Hmm.
But, of course, Dürer tries, you know, in his self-portrait to do it all, to be all of the Trinity, both of the Trinities, and... So the pictorial is so much the language of that entire century. It's like everything is explained through picture making. And so, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me that he has all of those roles. And you choose the sitter. And the sitter is a figure who, about midway through the 19th century, starts being vilified as stealing the agency of the photographer. The sitter it's usually a woman, push her into the background, make it flat and abstract, give her a role, you know, and always these, Robinson has these chapters in one of his books, managing the sitter. And always this notion that the sitter is a problem in photography that doesn't exist in painting, that there's always something obscene about her. And it's this disturbance from within, because, of course, the sitter is making the photograph. I mean, the sitter's body is the pencil, so to speak, that's tracing the image on the negative. And so it's as if the beholder from without and the sitter from within, and then this paranoia about the axis, the interaction or the relationship between the two of them. So I am so interested in the fact that you don't choose to, you're not a painter, you're not a photographer, you're dressed in black as he is, you're doing something with both your hands, which foregrounds the fact that he actually has suspended his role as author. He isn't painting, he's looking. And Joseph Kerner wrote this wonderful book about self-portraiture and the hand, the problem of the hand, that you can't look and paint at the same time. And the way, again, trying to conceal that in order to promote this myth of the theological author, that Dürer opens that space up, that there's no attempt to conceal that, and that everything becomes, it's as if the possibility of inhabiting these three roles is available to everyone, that it's almost a musical chair, musical chairs game. And so, yeah, I mean, you're sitting, your look is one which, if you hadn't been the photographer, you could get quite worked up about as stealing the picture, and the ornament with the hand, the cigarette in place of the brush, but no canvas, just this intense look. And then people like Dawson Day saying, we couldn't look at the figures in our early daguerreotypes because they seemed to be looking back and made us so ashamed. Just this, you know, this astonishing series of psychopathologies around all of that that is pretty interesting, and that is one of the many things that makes this so great.
Thanks, Kaja. I mean, what you have to say is way...
No,
it's way more exciting than, I think, especially what you've had to say about Las Meninas. I mean, I think I was really going on Foucault's complex triangulation of gazes.
But
and I think that that's...
I mean, I
like it too, but I'm just saying, like, it's so, I think you're touching on so many fabulous things that
I couldn't even say. It's almost as if, so the sitter, of course, is not, this is the fascinating thing that Roland Barthes says, oh, if I could only come out on paper like this or that, and I never look at photographs the way I want to, which is a dilemma that I know all too well. And so it's not as if the sitter is, in fact, as a subject performing this. It's actually a bodily intelligence. It's the manifestation. It's the eruption within a field that had foreclosed the object of this intelligence that everyone is talking about in the 19th century, and this intentionality. It's and so you indicate that with the hand. I mean that those fingers and that foot. It's really fascinating. So it's as if all of this idea of this drama, intersubjective drama during the taking of a photograph, which we fantasize is happening at the level of consciousness, is happening in a place that is much more challenging than consciousness. It's happening at a place that is part of us, an intelligence to which we, that is specific to our bodies and that other people can see, but that is utterly unavailable to us, and that is much more, that undoes us much more radically as monadic subjects than the unconscious ever could. So the 19th century is just full of this, and then of course we have all of these brilliant writers who follow from that, Hannah Arendt, Portman, all of the writers who talk about this strange aesthetic impulse flowering within the natural world, these forms of art making that have no consciousness behind them, that that Hannah Arendt starts, particularly raising to a kind of everything that is, no matter what, man-made, man or human, inhuman, artificial, natural, dead, alive, is meant to be seen, where that becomes this thing that, of course, art is so much about, seeing and being seen, where that is raised to the level of an overarching principle, and then meant to be by what? What means us to be that? I think it's, you know, Merleau-Ponty says, I'm a mind, I'm a gaze, but I'm also a thing in the world like other things. And why can't I, he says, who hate the subject-object binary, get beyond it? And we could all ask that question because it's so deeply etched. But that is the double structure of our being. And that's what's intending us to be seen. Oh, come on. You talk some more.
Oh, my God. How could I follow that? This is so beautiful.
So she says, she uses this notion of presupposed. We are presupposed by virtue of our being one of the visibles. We are presupposed to be seen by virtue of that. I think it's a very brilliant way of accounting for how something could be meant without positing some other world or some transcendental impulse. And
Being seen.
So Merleau-Ponty says, as I'm looking, it must be, so there's that imperative again, that I see myself, experience myself as seen, as one of the visibles, that wonderful word comes from him, from the place of the other, within the midst of the visible, looking from a particular point of view. In other words, as localized, finite, visible, and and I think that it's just kind of breathtaking idea. There's another kind of iteration of it. It's James Agee sitting in the tenant farmer's house in one of the two bedrooms, writing late at night, and he's facing the wall on the other side of which they're all sleeping. And he says, how can we care? No one can care beyond these rooms. How can we care beyond that wall? How can I get to that other side where I would care, which I have partitioned off in order to deny that I'm one of the visibles, in order to deny that I could ever be an object of vision, dependent as others are upon the look of the other. I have walled that off, and none can care beyond this room or be cared for beyond this room. And it's, you know, it's very, very overwhelming and seems to me deeply true and has to do with all of these private issues, that individuality that we've been talking about. So it's, I think, now the moment where we should have one last word from you. About recession, maybe?
Sure.
And then we'll have a little Q&A, and then we'll have a long reception.
Yes, with some wine. I'll just turn to this very kind of, it's just a one-off photograph over here called Recession. I was responding to the recession kind of in a very physical way. It's one of the last times I've photographed myself in my work, but so far, until now, which Kaja is advocating for, again. I think, what to say about it? It's...
There's a kind of wall there, too. So it's very Hopper-esque, obviously.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe something that I don't get to talk about very much with my work, but I do feel that there is, yeah, I think some humor to it, and that there's, I think, just the play on words, like the just thinking of the physical manifestation of a psychological state.
Yeah. But there, it's also like the tree that grows towards the sun. But here the sun is the world of commodities, the world of the world of commodities is having the same effect upon her that the sun would have upon the tree, and there's some kind of leaning into some kind of bodily yearnings. Very interesting. Harry told me that it was very hard to maintain that position.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not easy.